So, Jeffrey, this book kind of starts with like the Avengers having been killed or disappeared or something by this thing called Onslaught. It's not really explained at all in the book, so I'm kind of confused about what the whole Onslaught situation is.
Oh, well, that's really easy. Onslaught is the manifestation of Charles Xavier and Magneto's dark side amalgamated into a being.
Okay, see, I remember Onslaught because I read that in X-Men, but I don't remember exactly how this works with Professor X and Magneto. What's going on there?
Oh, well, see, back when the X-Men were fighting the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, Magneto pulled all the adamantium out of Wolverine's skeleton, and Professor X wiped Magneto's memory. And at that exact split second, a little psionic worm of Magneto's negativity jumped into Charles Xavier and started festering and growing his dark side, unbeknownst to Charles Xavier.
Wait, so Magneto is a worm made of adamantium?
No, just like the evil thoughts of Magneto kind of became a psychic worm that went into Charles Xavier's head, and then over several years started manifesting as this being called Onslaught.
Where did the worm come from?
It was just like the last vestiges of Magneto's personality escaping his head.
Okay, so how does this have to do again with the Avengers?
Oh, we'll see. The X-Men and the Avengers and the Fantastic Four had to fight Onslaught in Central Park, and they succeeded in cracking Onslaught's psionic armor open, but then he turned into a being of pure energy. And so then all of the Earth's Mightiest Heroes, the Avengers, the Fantastic Four, the Hulk, all had to absorb that energy, and then the X-Men had to destroy them.
Wait, the X-Men killed everybody.
Well, they thought they killed them, but actually, Franklin Richards, Reed Richards' son with omnipotent powers, pulled them all into a parallel universe that was like a big blue ball where the Heroes Reborn continuity was playing out.
Wait a second. Isn't Reed Richards' kid in this comic?
Yes.
If he was omnipotent, what's the problem?
He doesn't know that he's super omnipotent.
So he's omnipotent, but not omniscient about his own omnipotence.
Now I remember why I stopped reading superhero comics.
We haven't even got to how the Hulk got split into two people.
No.
I'm so confused.
Right.
Hello and welcome to the Trade Waiters. You might have been wondering about that weird cold open. That is an homage to Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, which is an excellent comic book podcast about X-Men continuity. And since this episode is going to be pretty Marvel comic continuity heavy, we thought we'd start with that.
Yeah, I listened to a lot of G and Miles when they started the podcast, but at a certain point I was just like, I don't want to understand the X-Men anymore. I'm sorry, no shame on them. They're doing great work, but like
I feel about the
I
X-Men
can't.
kind of the same way I feel about TikTok. You know, I've accepted it's not a thing I'm going to understand.
Fair. I used to understand the X-Men.
Good. That's a good outlook. To understand the X-Men, and then they changed what the X-Men was.
It's like, ironically, the X-Men is the one superhero comic that I feel like I have some grasp on. And it's like, it was interesting that they would come in and out of this series. And I was also like reflecting on the fact a little sadly, like, is this our first Marvel one that we've done?
No, we did Ms. Marvel.
Oh, that's right. That didn't feel anything like this.
No,
But
it
like
didn't.
the other two we did were DC, and I was feeling like, oh man, all that hard work I invested into trying to understand the DC universe is useless to me here.
Technically, Jessica Jones also was in the Marvel
Right,
universe.
right,
All
right.
right, okay. With Daredevil, right, okay.
And in fact, this is a good lead-in because the artist, the primary artist on this series is Mark Bagley. And Mark Bagley also did all of the Jessica Jones flashbacks when Jessica was remembering being a superhero.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, fun.
Yeah, and this was actually somewhat of a nostalgia trip for me because two of the major storylines in this series have art by Mark Bagley, who's our primary artist. And then there's the Spider-Man team-up issue with Sal Buscema. And those are my two favorite Spider-Man artists from when I was a teenager. But this series, being a Marvel series, it's primarily written by Kurt Busiek, but it's also written by Peter David, Roger Stern, and Jon Ostrander. And in addition to Mark Bagley and Sal Buscema, there's Mike Deodato Jr., Steve Epting, Geoff Johnson, Pasquale Ferri, Bob McLeod, Tom Grummet, Ron Randall, Gene Colan, Derek Robertson, George Perez, Chris Marinan, and Ron Frenz, as well as a cast of inkers, colorists, letterers, and editors. And I just want to try to give as much credit where credit's due before we start.
Fair. I think that's important.
There was one issue where the back had a credits page and it looked like they switched pencilers every four pages.
Yeah, I think
It was crazy.
issues like that are basically where you're like, oh, so you're behind on your deadline. Somebody dropped the ball and they had to just like churn out like an issue with like everyone has time to draw 3 pages each. Let's go.
Yeah.
You know what we
Wow.
haven't done yet is we haven't mentioned what the book is we're doing today.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
This
Sorry.
is reflective of Marvel being in the Marvel universe is things don't happen in an order that helps you to feel like you understand what's happening.
Yes. Also, if you clicked on this episode, you probably saw the title card, which is we are doing the Thunderbolts. We're doing their complete omnibus of the first story arc, which primarily covers Thunderbolts 1 to 12, but also includes their first appearance in The Hulk, number 449, Tales of the Marvel Universe, Spider-Man Team Up, number 7, and Heroes for Hire, number 7, among others. So this is basically the entire storyline of the Thunderbolts, seemingly in chronological order. This actually made me think about when I was 17, which is when this series came out. I used to organize my comics not by title, but I would organize them by timeline. So I would think about the overall storyline and I would organize my issues so that if you read them, you would read them in the story order, not necessarily the release date, or they weren't categorized by title. And so this compendium is very much like you were flipping through my back issue bin because you've got these random issues interspersed, though. I'm going to be pedantic here and I'm going to mention that technically the first appearance of the Thunderbolts was in Hulk number 450. That was their debut. And then the series launched. And I think this was a little bit of a strange choice that they put that after the first issue because the big twist of the series is revealed in the first issue. And I think part of, just to put this in context, this series happened as discussed after Onslaught. Marvel had shuttered all their major characters. The Hulk was still around, but the Avengers, the Fantastic Four, Thor, they basically were getting rebooted in a series called Heroes Reborn, and they were in a parallel universe. And so the existing Marvel universe only had Spider-Man and Daredevil and Heroes for Hire. And so they were hyping this new superhero team to get people excited. Like, we're replacing the Avengers with this team. And so you first read about them in the Hulk. And so then you go and pick up that first issue. And that's the first time that anyone would have discovered the big twist, which is that they're not heroes, they're villains posing as superheroes.
Sorry,
And
hang on. You find out the twist if you pick out Thunderbolts number 1.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So issue number one is where the twist appears, but they had sort of appeared in some supplemental material leading into issue number one. So like the way it's presented in this book is kind of out of order, in my opinion.
Well, that's kind of interesting because, well, we have other stuff to do, but the thing is then in that context, if you only were to encounter the Thunderbolts in these other anchor series, then you wouldn't know this like very obvious secret that is only revealed in, okay, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, like, I mean, and this is at a time where like there wasn't as much like internet spoilers. Like, it was easier to keep secrets like this. And like, again, speaking as someone who, you know, was reading Marvel Comics pretty avidly, like there was a big marketing campaign to get you to want to pick up this Thunderbolts number one and start reading it. And so like, they were selling it as a straight superhero series. And then they like pulled the rug out from under your feet with that first issue. Before we get too deep into this, I suppose we should also do some introductions of our own. And I did actually plan out a character building question. So do you feel imposter syndrome? And if so, how do you deal with it?
Ooh. I mean, yes. I don't know. Does anyone, are there people who don't feel, I guess there probably are people who don't feel imposter syndrome. how do I deal with it? I don't know. It's still here, so I guess I haven't. Just keep making stuff. It's not another option.
That's interesting.
Oh, I'm JD, by the way.
Yeah. Okay. I'm Jam, and I feel like imposter syndrome is something that comes in waves. And certainly when I was younger, I kind of had a just fake it till you make it way of getting through imposter syndrome, but I've found that it's shifted somewhat. And whenever I start to feel a little out of my depth, I remind myself of the things I've already done. And that helps me personally deal with it. But I mean, it relies on the hard work I've done for that to be a viable tactic, I think.
Yeah. All right. Those are good answers. I'm Jeff Ellis, and yeah, like, yes, I feel imposter syndrome all the time. And I mean, I think, yeah, similarly, I think I just refer to the evidence. Like, I have multiple emails and messages from students telling me how much they enjoyed my classes and how good an instructor they think I am. I have, you know, published books that some of which have won awards, like anthologies from Cloudscape that have won awards, some of which I helped out with. People come and tell me, thanks for doing what you do. Like, I just made a difference in my life. And so like that's the stuff I try to refer back to when I sort of have those moments of thinking, maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah. And so if you're a person who has ever said anything kind to another, just know that that goes a really, really long way. And it comes back to us in like our darkest moments when we try to remember that we need to keep going. So like when I finished my main webcomic, Wasted Talent, I got a flood of like really lovely messages. And I ended up picking like a few of my favorites and actually like printing them out and framing them so that they would be like physically on my wall and I could read them when I was specifically staring out into space and feeling dejected. I would put it right there. So it's like I could read that one.
Yeah, I know that other people have done that too. Like I always, whenever I get like a really good comment, especially if it's someone who like I have a lot of respect for and I'm amazed that they're even thinking about me at all, I always say to myself, oh, I should print that out. I should save that somewhere in a big file. And I haven't yet. I really should. That would be smart.
I recommend.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about the Thunderbolts. The two kind of primary creative forces are Kurt Busiek, which I was kind of excited to bring one of his comics in for us to look at. He's also notable for doing a limited series called Marvels, which has art by Alex Ross, and it is a civilian's perspective of living in the Marvel universe. And I think it's very different tonally from this work. He also has a creator-owned series of his own called Astro City, which is his sort of take on his own personal Marvel universe. which I think is also done in a little more of a serious manner. I haven't actually read it, but I believe it's a little more serious than the Thunderbolts. He also is credited with being the person who came up with a reason for Jean Grey to come back from the dead, John.
I mean, it was, and this is how it has been decided superhero comics work. Yeah. And I mean, her name is literally Phoenix. So, I mean, if anyone's going to come back from the dead.
So yes. there's like a plot point with the Black Widow. And I legit thought the Black Widow was Phoenix for a second.
Okay.
I had to like look it up. I'm like, no, these are different people. I thought I understood that reference. Aw.
But yeah, he's also really good friends with Scott McCloud. And then
they went to high school together.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then I won't go into too much detail about Mark Bagley's career, but one really interesting thing I did want to mention is in 1983, Marvel published a book called the Marvel Tryout Book, and it had scripts, penciled pages, and inked pages, and you could do sample pencils, sample ink, sample colors, etc., and you could submit it to a contest. And Mark Bagley won the art contest that they had done. And then nobody contacted him for like a year. And he went to a comic convention and he approached the editor-in-chief, Jim Shooter, and was like, hey, I won this contest. You haven't been in touch. And so then they gave him a job illustrating some of their playing cards. And then eventually he got a job on the New Warriors, and that launched his comic career. And he then transitioned over to being the main penciler on Amazing Spider-Man. And after that, started working on Ultimate Spider-Man. And for me personally, I associate Spider-Man with Mark Bagley. Like when I see Mark Bagley's art, I'm like, oh yeah, like those Spider-Man comics I read. And Mark Bagley is probably the number one reason I read this book when I was 17, when this came out. And I don't know, I just thought it would be fun to read something a little more lighthearted and silly. And in the process of reading it, I actually found myself thinking that this was actually oddly on point, because like you open the series and New York has suffered a devastating attack in 1997, and New York is reeling from this attack, and people are eager to throw their faith behind someone. And so this superhero team emerges, and secretly it's being led by a Nazi. So like secret Nazis playing on desperate people. And then the other thing I noticed throughout this whole book is so many of the villains they fight are basically tech bros that want to use technology to like control humanity. And I was just like, wow, there's like so many long-termists that they're like fighting in this series.
Yeah, so, it yeah. is really funny how that did seem to have like a very familiar vibe, let's say. But it just goes to show like how many of how early the seeds had been planted to get us where we are today. Like where our situation today feels chaotic and unbelievable, but it does not take much looking to see how things were stacked up over time. So yeah, that's a really good insight that it's like, oh, you know, this was all clear even back in the 90s, actually.
Yeah, I found that really interesting, actually, because like it was written at a time where I think people were much less afraid of Nazis. They were more of like, it's a historical phenomenon. Like there's some people who are still around who are like saying Nazi stuff, but you know, we don't have to take them too seriously. There's only a few of them. And I don't think the story, like I want to give credit to Kurt Busiek for, I think, having a pretty good idea of like what Nazis are like. Like, I don't think he has any wrong ideas about Nazis. I'm not sure you can say that about every writer ever. But because he didn't do the thing where like the main character who's a Nazi has any redeeming qualities whatsoever. Like he doesn't. And that's good. That's an accurate depiction. But I also feel like because it was written in 1997, it's not scared. This story is not scared of Nazis. It's right. Nazis are like an easy villain. Everybody hates them, and rightly so. Let's get a someone that everyone's gonna like rightly hate, and like see what we can do with that. Not this is something that I'm worried about is gonna happen in the next 10 years, and you should all start paying attention.
Yeah,
it's like no one would have known that. I mean, at least I don't know who would have known that.
Academics who study fascism.
Yeah. I
at
mean,
that
I guess.
Point, we're probably the only ones who are really seriously talking about that. And
yeah.
Otherwise, I think you're right, JD. It was a pretty isolated opinion.
So this was like a little bit of a nostalgic read for me. And I definitely found myself just having thoughts about Marvel Comics in general, because like Marvel Comics, especially I think at this time, this was right after they had declared bankruptcy. So Marvel had declared
bankruptcy right.
in 1996. Yeah. And so then they were bought by Toy Biz, which ironically, Toy Biz had been a spin-off company from Marvel.
Yeah, they were a toy company. They made the action figures that for the Marvel characters.
And so
they wanted to still keep doing that, so they bought Marvel Comics.
Yeah, so basically like Marvel, when they went bankrupt, sold off Toy Biz. Toy Biz became a functioning, healthy company and then bought Marvel because Marvel was floundering. And so this was part of their kind of restructuring plan because they believed that like all of their core line had gone stale, right? So the Fantastic Four and the Avengers just, there was too much continuity. It was too messy. They were alienating new readers. And so the idea was they were going to push a reset button on their core teams. And so that was where they had like Jim Lee redoing the Fantastic Four and Rob Liefeld redoing Captain America, et cetera, in this separate line of books. And while that was happening, to fill that gap, they started putting out some new material in their existing universe. And so the Thunderbolts was one of the primary new releases for that. And so it was really playing off the idea of the missing superheroes. And so that becomes this omnipresent thing throughout the series, is like, which again, this is sort of the other thing, is you have all these editors for all these different lines, and they're all sort of going back up to the editor in chief. And so I think I mentioned before we started recording that I'm not convinced that Kurt Busiek knew when the heroes were coming back or if the heroes were coming back. And so I think at a certain point, he just got a memo saying, hey, yeah, the heroes are coming back next month. So figure out what you're going to do about that. Deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff. I was going to say, like, I thought this book was a very good pick for the Trade Raiders specifically, and I will tell you why. First of all, I think that this period is kind of a sweet spot in Marvel Comics, because before this, with no shade at all to the greats who worked in the era before this and did the work of figuring it all out, those earlier comics, if you go back down to like the origin of some of these characters, those earlier comics can be rough around the edges. In terms of writing style, drawing style, and even just like the conventions of cartooning. Whereas I feel by this point, they've figured that it's this all out. However, it is before I feel like a lot of these comics went off the rails, especially in terms of coloring. Like there's a point after this where coloring just gets really extreme. Like they got real excited about the gradient tool. I think we've mentioned this in the past, and it just gets whoa crazy. And there are gradients in this work, but it's very restrained. And yet it feels more dimensional than there's even like an internal flashback in this comic. And that feels super flat compared to the coloring style of this comic. So I think for that reason, it's a really nice pick. The other thing is I felt like this chunk was internally satisfying. And whereas in other, so I was definitely confused at points, like the beginning. but I felt as I was reading this, I was thinking to myself, it's like, I feel like I understand 80% of what is happening 80% of the time, which is better than has been for other comics. So that's enough. That's for me to keep Perfect. Going and feel like I'm getting somewhere.
Yeah, I'll be honest, reading this was a bit of a slog. It was if I hadn't been preparing to like do a podcast about this, I don't think I would have made it very far through this book. I'm gonna try to focus more on the positives than the negatives because, to be honest, a lot of the negatives are stylistic. They're subjective. They're things that I'm not looking for in comics. But I also like I was reading these exact same creators, not these exact characters, because I never read Thunderbolts in the 90s. I did read other comics that were happening at the same time. I read Onslaught. I don't remember it very well, apparently. but like I'm sure like I loved Marvels, which was also Kurt Busiek. That was one of my standout books. But I think just the whatever the combination is of the subject matter and the style, like it's maybe this would have been for me at some point. It is not currently for me. So I'm going to try to keep my criticisms more to like things that could be better within the context that this story was written in, because this is not the context that I'm mostly interested in.
Right.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
had the same kind of line of thinking, JD. I feel like my struggles with superhero comics frustrate me a little bit because I don't like the idea of there being a type of comic that I don't like. And as I was reading this, I was trying to pin down, I'm like, what exactly is it that is the problem? Because I was reading Trigun at the same time, and Trigun, you're going to have to stop me from talking about Trigon for too long. Let's just say it was a heroic effort to stay on Thunderbolts and not just keep reading Trigon. But Trigon is just as ridiculous. It makes less sense than this probably, and it has like all sorts of these outlandish characters and big battles, and I'm like, what's the difference? What's the difference between these comics really? And I landed on the fact that the things that make this a superhero comic, the things that make people excited to read a superhero comic, are the specific elements I don't like. So one of the things I noticed, so there's this like continuity thing, and I was reading some of the back matter. I will be honest, I did not read all the back matter that's contained in this omnibus, but I read some of it, and they're like, oh man, it's so cool how like this other character comes in from left field, and I know so much about this other character, and they're interacting, and wow, that's awesome. And like, that's an aspect I don't like. And I also noticed that this was very narration forward.
Right.
So this is something that is present throughout all superhero comics, but because it's so forward in this comic in particular, it was finally loud enough for me to notice it. And it's like, oh my God, it feels like there's more description of what is happening than actual, it's like an illustrated prose sometimes, it feels like.
Yeah.
I feel like this is going to be a big discussion because I have things to say about this too.
Okay.
This is going to come back to what our main topic for this episode is going to be.
So let me just put a pin in that thought then. So it's like at the end of the day, I kind of had to come to the conclusion that I don't like superhero comics the same way I don't like war movies, where it's just like the things I don't like are intrinsic to the genre. So similar to JD, I don't want to be unfair to this book. I thought it was well constructed for what it is.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, rereading this, I think like it there were still things I liked, but I actually found like there were things that jumped out at me where I was like, wow, like I don't think I noticed this the first time I read these. And I think that's you were mentioning the narration, which I think that was something that really started to drive me crazy because I realized like I had the advantage when I first read this work because I was reading it as the issues came out. So I would read an issue and then a month would go by and I would forget things and then I would read the next issue. And the repetition isn't as pronounced as when you read them back to back. And it's like every 24 pages, they're like, as we know, the evil masters of evil are posing as superheroes. In the absence after Onslaught. And it's like the first time they set it up, you're like, that's great. But then every 24 pages, they have to kind of remind you what the premise is because they're assuming someone's a new reader at that moment, right? This is somebody's first contact point. And so we have to catch you up every 24 pages.
We have that problem in anime sometimes too.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
just like so many flashback sequences. And if you watch them all in sequence, you're like, we get it.
Right.
And I think that's a big part of this having been written in 1997, when you couldn't binge this.
Right.
Like that would be nearly impossible. Like you couldn't just download it all and then read it all at once. There was no plan probably to release this in trade ever. So it's just like the only way anyone's going to read this is either they have a subscription to it and they're getting a new issue every month in their box at their local comic store, or you find a bunch of them in a long box in the comic convention. And so you and you might be miss you might miss an episode. You might have like 1 through 5 and then 7 and 9, and then that's what you're reading. So it is comics. A lot of the comics that we look at on Trade Readers are subject to their method of delivery. Like the structure of the work is hugely influenced by that, and different worlds of comics have very different methods of delivery. And there, I don't know. I mean, graphic novels, we do a lot of graphic novels on Trade Readers because it's one book. It's the right length for the format that we're doing. You can read it beginning to end, and then that's the end of the story. But that's still a format, right? Like that story is subject to the format of like how much you can fit within a book before it has to become two books.
And then I don't know, and I think that then the other thing that stood out to me was just that the breakneck pace, where like even within those 24 pages, like we gotta like go 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 go. And then that was the thing that really stood out, is just like people explain, is that because we always talk about, or I always talk to my students about like show don't tell. And I feel like reading these, it was like tell don't show. It's like oh no, I've been knocked into the anti-gravity well. Oh, but I've got my anti-gravity immunity belt, so now I can just jump forward. And then you're like on to the next sequence, because like they don't have time to do 8 panels to walk you through that. So they just had to have the characters explain it to you in a dialogue box. We can like go.
Yeah, it's interesting. So again, sorry to bring up Trigun again, but Trigun is like the exact opposite of this, where they explain nothing, nothing at all. And the pages, like the artist is kind of infamous for the fact that like his pages are almost incomprehensible at times. And so like there's a lot of debate online about like what exactly is happening here. And nobody really knows for sure, because there's just like a whole mess of art and it just says shoom. And so it was really interesting to have like the specifics of what was going on there, but I did find that the balance wasn't quite there for me. But it did bring a lot of texture and interest into like the specifics of what is happening, because a lot of it was very technological. Things like if you had tried to depict it, I don't know if it would have made sense anyway. So it brought an interesting layer to like how some of these powers work and interact. And I did appreciate that.
Yeah, and I think this is how like a lot of my criticism is style, because like I know that I was reading comics that were exactly this style throughout like the 90s. And I think I at a certain point I started reading a lot more graphic novels and manga and far fewer monthly superhero comics. And I think my approach to reading or my expectations as a reader changed, because this style of writing didn't used to bother me. When I was reading this all the time, like this was just what comics were. And I don't want to say that this that like showing and not telling is inherently better, because like what does that mean? But yeah, I think that's I've fallen I because I have this problem with a lot of European comics too, where they're very condensed. Like they're not necessarily to the point where like you have like half of the dialogue is narration all the time, but there's still like each panel could almost be like a standalone chapter, essentially. Like if you gave this to like Naoki Urasawa, he would turn like one page into one chapter of a book.
I
And
can see
it
that.
would have the same amount of story, and it would be a very different way of telling it. And I know that I prefer one over the other, but that doesn't Like there's no way that Marvel could do that. Like that's not physically possible with the restrictions of the medium they find themselves in.
But not only that, they have collectively defined a style. So a lot of this is also very tropey in a way, not in a bad way. I'm not saying in a bad way. I'm saying as a collective, they have very much defined their house style. And kind of what I was saying about this era is that they have now at this point figured this out. And they're all just, they've agreed to work in this style. And this feels very of that style. So it feels very silly to say like, oh, but the style though. It's like, this is the style.
Oh man, why are all these cubist paintings like
yeah.
weird with all the sides visible? Like, I don't get
it. Yeah, it's like Picasso's fine and all, but I really wish he would close his shapes, you know, like it's like, okay, but.
And I think on the one hand, I feel like this style of writing is maybe a barrier to new readers. Like even when this was, when even when it was the 90s, I feel like this is it might be reflective of why superhero comics always had such a hard time getting new readers, that it's just such a dense storytelling method that it's hard to find where to start, hard to get into it. Once you're in it, then it's fine. You can just like sort of ride the wave. But like you would never be able to do like you never be able to do Smile in this format because you wouldn't get people to hit the ground running with it.
That's funny. Trying to imagine
Yeah.
And I feel like superhero, like some of the more recent superhero comics that we've read on Trade Raiders, I haven't felt this issue as much. I think the people working on these comics have also been influenced by manga and graphic novels to a large extent, and have sort of incorporated those storytelling styles into their work in a way where it's less of a jump for me to go back and forth. But this was the sort of the 90s style of superheroes. I've often referred to it as like mannerism in the sense of, after the early Renaissance, or after the mid Renaissance, there was this the art styles of like Michelangelo were they're often called mannerism, where Michelangelo isn't trying to be like correct perspective, correct anatomy, everything is perfectly like how you would see it in real life. He's like that, but I'm bored of that, and I wanted to like be more creative, be more subjective. And like Michelangelo is obviously not a bad artist, so I want to put this in that context where you can be a mannerist, and that's not it shouldn't be taken as lesser.
Right.
It's just it's for people who are familiar with your medium and can follow you down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I feel like after this point, and after we went through like the gradient hell, there was a certain restriction back into realism that happened within Marvel Comics. So we think about like Jessica Jones and even that Hawkeye that we read, it feels a lot more realism based, let's say, like anchored in a reality, whereas this feels very stylized, like, you know, even down to like the posing and the with the dialogue and the narration, like it just gives this very grand impression. And it's like the world takes on a certain sheen when you think of it in this reality.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I know that Busiek did Marvels before this in 1994, and that was like a much more, I don't know, like modern feeling writing style.
It's very cinematic. Yeah,
this felt like a little bit of a step back for him as a writer. And again, I don't know all the ins and outs, but I'm almost wondering if he had an editor that was like, oh, no, like, we have to write it this way. It has to sort of fit the house style. We need you to explain things in narration. And like, I mean, some of the like stuff that stood out to me was like almost like pedantic, like where they were like trying to head off fan criticisms ahead of the release. Like they're fighting the elements of doom, and it's like, they're like, oh, they're going into their citadel in Central Park. And they're like, wait, how come no one said anything about there being a citadel in Central Park? And they're like, oh no, I just saw it spring up a minute ago. And you're just like, do we need to know this? Like, why is this important? And I was like, oh, this feels like they're writing to the pedantic fan that's going to write them a letter. Like, how would people not know that the Citadel was in Central Park?
Oh, it's interesting.
Responding to fan backlash before the backlash. Like,
it's interesting because I feel like the demographic of readership at this point would have become, just like recently, become that kind of people who would be inclined to write a letter about something like detailed like that. Whereas before, an editorial oversight might be more around making it comprehensible to a younger readership.
Mm.
And so some of this explanation is like, make sure an 11-year-old can figure out what's going on, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think like early days of superhero comics were essentially for kids. The innovation that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby came up with Fantastic Four and Avengers and Spider-Man wasn't Jack Kirby, but you know what I mean, was that, oh, we're going to do the comics for kids, but they're going to be for like teenagers now. We're going to catch all those teenage readers who were aging out of reading Superman and Batman. So yeah, this in the 90s, it wasn't necessarily just teenagers anymore. It was a lot of adults as well, because the readership kept aging.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, the other thing that stood out was like all the notes about like, see this issue, like as explained in like Avengers number 25, like this battle as of like Iron Man number 50.
And I couldn't handle it.
this is that Marvel style where it's like, we want to bring you into this universe, and then we don't want you to just read one book. We want you to read everything. So everything's interconnected. And so there's always new rabbit holes for you to explore. There's always back issues for you to hunt for. And like, again, I think pre-internet, a lot of the Marvel fandom was the letter section, right? It was letters and getting responses, getting your letter published. Like, I remember when I got my letter published in Alpha Flight, and like, it was so exciting, you know, like they even printed my envelope art. But it's like, there was like this whole mail and like letter writing sort of thing that like, it was like, instead of a message board, instead of like an online forum, you'd write letters to Marvel Comics and you'd respond to other people's letters. And like, I don't know, it's hard to describe to someone who's like Gen Z, because it probably makes no sense to them, but like, it was like before the internet, like there was this whole kind of fandom and community that was like based on like collecting, reading these floppies, writing letters to the editors, like talking to your friends about it, like speculating on what's going to happen in the next issue.
Yeah, it's more like a magazine in that sense, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That the floppy nature, the periodic nature was a big aspect of it. And yeah, I think that's important. I'm glad the letters were included in the omnibus, despite me not reading them. Like having them there did help give a little bit of the flavor of like the give and take that was there between the people writing this and the fandom responding to it. And because it was very... there's a very tight turnaround, which perhaps we can discuss, involved in the creation of some of these issues. So it would have been possible for the teams to somewhat respond to how people were responding and respond to the fan responses, right? And in that sense, like it's very clear that they're concerned about living to fight another day as a creative team. You know, they want you to keep buying. They want you to keep reading. And so that fan responsiveness is a big part of it. It's a very dynamic style of crafting a narrative.
Yeah, we were going to talk a little bit about the Marvel method. So, Jeff, do you want to explain the Marvel method for anyone who is not familiar with this book certainly was created, and a lot of books from this time period and earlier were created?
Yeah, I mean, the Marvel method was that you had your writer who would kind of have an outline of a plot and write out a description of like what was supposed to happen. And then the artist would lay out all of the events and the actions. And then the writer would like put the dialogue in where appropriate. So basically, like, there was kind of a loose outline. The artist would go to town, and then the writer would sort of finalize the dialogue at the kind of lettering stage. And this was just to kind of increase output, because then the writer can be passing vague outlines to the artist and then sharpening the dialogue at the lettering stage. But then that also means that if the artist has their own ideas about things, the story can kind of move in different directions. And like, famously, some collaborations have ended over the fact that the artist was not respecting the writer's intentions, or vice versa. Like, that was famously, I think, what was it? In X-Men, Chris Claremont and John Byrne parted ways because Chris Claremont wrote about like Colossus like straining to pull this tree out of the ground, but then John Byrne just had him like rip it out with like one hand, like with ease. And like, Chris Claremont is like, I'm tired of you undermining my words, like the picture like express the scene.
So like, it's a really strange way to work. Like, I can see how
fast
for artists this is like a potential advantage, because like, you have a lot more say over the storytelling. But on the other hand, like, this is all basically just copying how Stan Lee liked to work. And like, that him and Jack Kirby, that famously didn't end well, in part because Jack Kirby wasn't getting credit for any of the storytelling work he was doing. Stan Lee was just taking all the credit for creating the characters, where he had just given Jack Kirby an outline.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a strange way to work. Like, I could be like, in 1997, I'm not sure if this was the exact same method, or if maybe like there was a little bit more detail in the scripts going out. But I definitely would say at this time period, it was really about finding that synergy between artist and writer. And I think that if you didn't have that sort of synergy between the two creators, like, your series wasn't going to work. And I definitely found it very jarring, like, when they had the like failed deadline issue, where it was like three different people working on every page. Like, feels way more disjointed, where you have different artists, than when you have a more cohesive, just like singular artist, singular writer, or even preferably where they like, at least when they do flashbacks, and it's like, okay, one artist is doing the flashbacks, one artist is doing the main timeline. That kind of works, but there's definitely some issues where it was like, oh, like, you just had to grab whoever was available to like keep drawing this, because you needed to hit your press deadline. And that's always makes it a little bit weaker. But I think, like, in addition to just the writing approach, like, I think that this also was the time where Marvel was really focused on the Marvel universe and the shared aspect. And so I think that, you know, there's this crazy structure of like, you have your editor in chief, and then you have your like executive editor, and like each sort of subdivision has an editor. There's an X-Men editor, there's like a main superhero editor, there's a Spider-Man editor, and then they all have their like assistant editors working under them. And so, like, you know, I think as a creator, you have a lot of cooks in the kitchen who are kind of like overseeing you and being like, oh no, like, next month Captain America is going to come back, so we can't have this happen here. You have to adjust your story. Or like, you know, I think there's just a lot of like editorial oversight. And that's where some of the weaker parts of the writing, I almost wonder, like, was that Kurt Busiek's first draft, or was that like an editor being like, no, like, we need to set up this, or we need to make sure we explain this, because I don't have any faith in the readers to understand it. Where I feel like, after, in about 1998, Joe Quesada took over as editor-in-chief, and that's, I think, where you started to see more naturalistic writing. Like, that's where Brian Michael Bendis took center stage, and that's where I think Marvel really shifted away from this like house style and started just letting creators be creative. And that, like, Jessica Jones comes out of that era, right? And so I think that, and Hawkeye comes out of that era. So I think that this is sort of a anachronism of like a time before the shackles were taken off, so to speak.
That makes sense. Yeah, it definitely felt chaotic in a certain, narratively chaotic, let's say. It felt like there were a lot of threads going on and a lot of juggling. So the way that you're describing the overarching goals at Marvel at the time makes sense when I reflect on the way it's written.
And like, this is where I want to be less negative, because as much as I didn't enjoy reading a lot of this, like what I did enjoy was I enjoyed the premise. I enjoyed the, like, I found the second half much more interesting. I really liked the characters better once we had a backstory for each of them, where I could actually start to care about them halfway through reading hundreds of pages. And so I feel like it's impressive that Kurt Busiek was able to get a story that actually has a beginning, middle, end within this ridiculous format.
Yeah.
Because not very many people could manage to do that.
And I agree with you, JD. I did like the beginning, middle, end that they came up with in the end. So like that there was this vacuum of power that occurred, and a group of supervillains decided to take advantage of this vacuum of power by pretending to be superheroes. But then some of the people within the group decided they actually liked being superheroes, and it caused conflict within the team. And so when it reached the end game of now we have to seize on the power that we've been doing this, there actually was an internal strife, and some of the super villain turned superheroes were not on board with that anymore. Anyway, that's how I would summarize the plot, so you can tell me how much I got.
No, yeah, I mean that's it. And like, I really liked how all of that felt intentional. Like, as much as the stuff about, like, oh, the Avengers are back now, like, I don't know, maybe Jeff is right, and that was not part of the original plan, but the fact that he could get his original plan, and was clearly, this clearly was the plan from the beginning, because all the seeds were there.
Yeah, and they did follow it, like, little nuggets in the beginning that then, like, bloomed. I thought that was really well, especially with, not Beetle, the ship guy. And song, whatever.
Songbird.
Sorry. So part of my problem is, like, I know we're dealing with the positives here, but part of my negative is that everyone seems to have three or four names, and I get very confused. So Songbird and, sorry, remind me, Mach whatever?
Mach 1.
Songbird and Mach 1. So yeah, like the seeds of them, you know, they care about each other, and their relationship is slowly blooming, and they're like, actually, like, doing good things is kind of good sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is and I will say, like, I had a moment where I realized, like, each character has a civilian name, a villain name, and a superhero name,
and then at the same time, like, they've all changed their faces. Like, not only do you have to deal with, like, multiple different artists drawing the same character, sometimes in costume, sometimes out of costume, but they literally, according to the story, have changed their face. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Not an easy thing to draw.
Yeah, I had to write it all out to make sure it made sense to me. But like, yeah, I mean, I think the core reason I recommended this was because, like, I think that core idea of villains posing as heroes and then kind of realizing that being a hero maybe is more rewarding than being a villain. Like, I think that I love that as a premise. And, like,
yeah, that part was good.
I don't think execution was as good as it could have been, but like, I think that I just love that as a concept. And yeah, like, they did a good job of kind of touching on the motivations for these characters to have become villains in the first place. And so, you know, especially like with, yeah, like Mach 1, it's like, yeah, he wanted respect, and like, he ended up taking this path where he was like a bank robber. But then once he like had this sort of do-over, he's like, oh, I could use my engineering skills for good instead of evil. And like, this actually makes me feel better. Makes me feel good about myself. I think in 2024, I like would like more people to consider that if the world's casting them in the role of villain, that maybe doing good things for people, they might feel better about themselves. They might actually find doing nice things for people is rewarding. I would encourage.
But at the same time, I also like that the story like argued against itself in a certain sense, where it has this whole backstory with this story that Black Widow tells about Hawkeye and Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch.
Oh yeah.
And, like, this was from like the 60s. This is long before I was reading superhero comics or anything, because I wasn't alive. But this whole sort of story about how they were villains who became like core Avengers, and like it didn't go well for them because like people didn't like them.
I didn't know that at all about those characters.
Oh, I only knew it vaguely. I'd never read any of those stories.
Yeah.
But I like that because, like, yeah, no, just because you're suddenly a good guy, like, that doesn't mean everything's going to go well for you. It never goes well for Spider-Man.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Marvel has a long track record of reforming their villains into heroes.
Yeah, and I think this story does a really good job of sort of thinking about that.
Yeah.
As a concept.
Yeah, I that was actually, I think, one of my favorite issues of the series was that particular issue where the Black Widow's talking to Mach 1 and Songbird about Quicksilver, the Scarlet Witch, and Hawkeye, and just kind of this, yeah, like you're right, that they were more openly villains just now trying to reform, and society was pushing back against them. But I don't know, I thought it fit well, this idea of like, well, just because you were a villain doesn't mean you're a villain forever. You can sort of recast your narrative and like...
Except if you're Baron Zemo and you're literally a Nazi, then there's
He was nuts. So like that was probably the one major struggle that I had. Not the only one. That was a major struggle that I had with this overarching narrative is Baron Zemo's core motivation. And like the motivation maybe made sense in terms of like, you know, his dad was bad and he's also bad, as it turns out. But what I couldn't quite understand was his objective then. So it's like, right, he has a motivation and his objective is to take over the world for reasons, just to be bad. Like I wish I had more clarity. I wish he had like a really specific thing that he was griping about and a really specific objective to do. I felt like it was a little bit too nebulous and vague. And also because the other villains had somewhat lesser in terms of the evil scale, I find like they had lesser motivations in terms of villain. I didn't fully understand why they would be on board, like why they would be very motivated by this Baron Zemo plot.
Yeah, like I feel like this comes back for me to this being written in 1997, and I don't think Kurt Busiek had a lot of personal experience with Nazis. And so the concept of being a Nazi is more of a fictional thing at that point, where he's trying to understand this thing he's never met. And like, that's not a bad thing to try to do. But
you
I
know,
feel like
congrats,
we all live in a world.
Met a Nazi. I'm proud of you. Like,
what's that?
I'm really glad he never had to meet a Nazi. That's great.
I think it was possible to live your whole life that way in the 90s.
Perhaps.
Turn out right. But yeah, like I feel like we all have not necessarily in person, but at least online, met Nazis. And the thing about Baron Zemo, he's just not petty enough. He's too smart. He's too willing to like put his like whatever his Nazi stuff is in a box and say, okay, I'm gonna let this out of the box first chance I get, and then behave normal. Like, I don't think that's very typical.
Yeah, it's true. It doesn't feel crazy enough.
But that's only from the benefit of like experience, right?
I mean, I would say like that was probably like one of the weak points, is that I think Zemo really was quite the like mustache twirling. I mean, again, I'm saying in my Marvel comic, this guy was a really two-dimensional villain. But like, yeah, I mean, I think that Zemo did lack a certain amount of depth, which is, I mean, I don't want to get super off topic, but like, he showed up in like an issue of Spectacular Spider-Man like years before I read this book, and like, he was terrifying, and he was like doing experiments on people, and there was like kind of veiled like allusions to like child abuse, and like having him show up in this series, I was like, well, no, he's the worst. But like, I think his evil was never quite as fully pronounced as other iterations I've read of his character.
It's interesting.
One of the more of a two-dimensional cardboard cutout villain in this series. And you were saying, like, you know, he's like almost like not Nazi enough. I would say this might also come back to like Marvel editorial, because like we're trying to make a book that's like for teens in 1997.
Yeah.
We don't want to get too overtly accurate to Nazi.
I'm not sure I was asking for accuracy. I'm
yeah.
not sure I was asking for accuracy. I think
sorry.
I was asking for specifics.
Right.
And what's interesting is that Baron Zemo, I feel like his bearing, the way he's drawn and the way he behaves actually feels more interesting and compelling than the nuts and bolts of what you get in terms of his motivation and plot. And I think that's maybe where the fuzziness is coming from me, because he does like feel very imposing, like the way he's drawn, like he shows up and he's like, I am here to be Citizen V and all these people are behind me. Like, he does really feel all the time like he's in charge of the situation, and he has a very clear plan, and the clear plan is ? Power, you know. Like, and I think that's where I fall off, right? But
well,
no, I don't need accurate depictions.
Yeah, sorry.
I don't need more people to be given the step by step of this.
What I was meaning is, yeah, like maybe part of the vagueness might be that, like, well, we don't necessarily want to get too specific about what his end goal is, because that might not clear the comics code.
I'm not sure that that's
it. Could
it.
Be cartoonish.
Yeah.
And more specific.
More cartoonish than using a mental modem to like mind control 60% of the people on Earth.
That was a specific method, but that wasn't his objective.
Right.
His objective, and now we're being pedantic, but like his objective was to just like gain power.
Right.
And like, and then we'll all be like rich is kind of how we'll be rich and powerful was kind of how it was painted. And that's the part that felt vague.
Right.
And like, even if we compare it to like Mad Love, with like the Joker wanted to get Batman into this tank of piranhas so that he would die because he got pissed off at something. It's like that felt more specific, even though it was very cartoonish.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the specific take over the world plan for sure was like that's the plan. Okay.
I mean, I do think that like this speaks to maybe that they were flying by the seat of their pants a little bit, because like ultimately Zemo's method of taking over is utilizing this technology that the Thunderbolts prevented someone else from using in that Spider-Man team-up issue. And so it's just kind of like, I mean, again, I don't know, maybe this was like part of the whole outline from the beginning, but it rang a little bit like, okay, like, I don't know, how does Zemo take over the world? We got to figure this out before issue 12. Hey, remember that mind control thing? What if, because remember, Techno grabbed those blueprints. So what if, there we go, you know?
Yeah, like as much as I feel like the character arcs were really solid, and those were played out according to a plan that was there from the beginning, maybe the actual take over the world scheme was subject to, oh, suddenly we have to do the finale right now, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's again.
But we gotta cut it off here, because we're already running long. So we're gonna do a whole other episode.
Yes.
We'll have a lot more to talk about for the story in that episode, I think.
Yes.
Any final thoughts on this episode?
I'm glad we're doing this. Let's put it.
We're gonna have a lot to talk about. So
I think we're getting down to some interesting aspects of what these comics are and how we react to them, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you guys enjoyed. Or somewhat enjoyed this experience, because I was a little bit going into it, I was like, I don't know, maybe I really dropped the ball on this recommendation.
We're enjoying recording this episode.
We're learning and growing.
There we go. All right.
I would like to shout out Short Box Comic Fair.
Ooh, yes.
Which is going on right now. It's an incredible all online expo of indie comics. I drop a lot of cash on it every year, and I never regret any of it because the comics that come out of this are super, super high quality. Many of the comics that we reviewed in our mini comics awards came out originally of the Shortbox Comic Fair. So if you want to read some really innovative stuff from artists that are all around the world and you want that money to go right back to the artists, please check out the Shortbox Comic Fair.
I have only been reading things that are in my library so I can get to know the books in my library. So everything, all my shout outs are going to be books for kids right now. and not necessarily comics. I'll start with the one that is a comic. I have been reading Sailor Moon by Naoko Takeuchi, which I watched that show like religiously when I was a teenager, but I never actually read the book. And
it's
it holds
quite
up.
Different. Yeah.
It's different, but it's like different in a way where I can like draw a direct line, like, oh, it's this because this. Right? So it's not like a totally different story. It's the same story just told in a different way.
I like the Sailor Moon manga. I think it's fun.
Yeah.
It's very pretty.
Yeah. And technically superheroes.
There we go.
From the 90s.
I'm Jeff Ellis. I'm just going to shout out Gamerville by Johnny Christmas. I just picked it up for my birthday, and so far, so good.
I have that in my to-read pile. Haven't read it yet.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good follow-up to Swim Team, I'm going to say.
I would like to shout out a new podcast about comics. So Evan Dam, who is the creator of Third Voice and Vatu, which is a series that we've reviewed on the Trade Waiters, has started putting out a podcast called Flat Art Show. So this is a, let's call it an early press review, because I've only managed to listen to the first half hour of the first episode. I'm sorry, Evan, I need more time to listen to podcasts. But so far, it seems to be very deep into talking about the creative process and creativity and how you manage your ideas. And it involves some of what I consider the titans of indie comics. So definitely, if you're tired of waiting for us Trade Waiters to put out more talking about comics, then check it out. Let it be music to your ears.
That's exciting. I'm going to look for that.
So next episode is more Thunderbolts.
Yeah. The Trade Waiters is presented by Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music. You can find us on the internet and anywhere you find good podcasts. Thanks for listening.